Back in the 40s, Dorsey Schock and I worked on a little problem which came to me from the NGAA, the Natural Gasoline Association of America, I think it's called. A fellow by the name of Tom Bacon of Lone Star Gas Company had a problem, and he had heard that somebody in Austin, he was in Dallas, somebody in Austin was working in the field of corrosion inhibition, and he came down to see me one day, and his problem was that the Lone Star Gas Company had a couple of wells out in Opelika Field, which was about 100 miles east of Dallas. I forget what it was near. And the problem was that they had two wells sitting fairly close to each other. These were condensate wells, natural gas condensate wells. And one of them, the Tullis number two, gave them all kinds of trouble, but Tullis number one was fine. And they just didn't understand it. And they wondered if I would be interested in trying to help them understand it. Well, that was fairly new. I was already consulting for Mobil, but that was different. I'd go to Mobil and listen to their problems and let them talk until they found the solutions and then go home. This was to help this fellow Bacon find out what was wrong. And I thought a long time about it, but then I decided, well, I wouldn't put a lot of time in on it, but I'd go out and see what was up. At any rate, Schock had been a graduate student of mine who couldn't pass organic, so the organic prelim just killed him. So he stopped with a master's degree, and we opened this corrosion research lab out of what was the old magnesium plant, currently the back Alconi's Research Center. And this was an ideal problem for him. It required an understanding of the system. It wasn't a degree program. So in essence, the first of the research assistants appeared that way. Again, it was moving the university into what it's now doing, perhaps more than it should, but it's doing it. Anyway, we decided that the way to find out what was going on was to expose some coupons in the flow line of the two wells. And we did. Sure enough, the coupon in the Tullis number one corroded very rapidly. The Tullis number two didn't. And when we looked at these with what now appears to be very unsophisticated instrumentation, it was sophisticated, but with optical systems interference things, we detected a film on the one that didn't grow, but a thin film. It didn't alter the appearance of the metal, for example. You still got the iron, the steel color through. And the other one didn't have anything like that. It was very rough and corrugated and so on. And my first statement to Bacon was, you might have the same name on both of these, but they're not coming from the same horizon. I was naive enough to believe that those guys knew everything there was to know about the field, but the fact is they didn't know a damn thing about it. When they decided to test my proposition, turns out they weren't from the same horizon. They were at the same depth, mm-hmm. but the horizon dipped. So that was the first thing. The second thing, and they did, which they did, second thing I suggested to them they wouldn't do, namely take the flow from Tullis number two and take it down below and bring it up, because I propositioned them that there was a natural inhibitor in this Tullis number two horizon. And that's when I got interested in it, because I went to Dr. Lochte, who I told you was an organic chemist, and he did a lot of extraction of things from crudes. and he suggested it may be naphthenic acids. And so we began to do some studies on naphthenic acids, and sure enough, we could reproduce those films easily. That was the principal contribution of the Corrosion Research Laboratory, because from there on I got quite interested in this business of organic materials in low concentrations and the influence they had on the metal interface, metal solution interface. I then ran across an article which was not in the scientific literature but in the technical literature, which described the introduction of toluidines into a system that was corroding petroleum system, the water from a petroleum system. And the toluidines were found to be different from one another, orthotoluidine being much more effective than either para, meta, or toluene. And it was known as the ortho effect. And that's all. It was dropped right there, you know. The guy, I think somebody out of Tulsa, maybe City Service or whoever was it, or Exxon's lab, or probably. And I wondered, why was the ortho position so important? I got us started on the interest and structure of the organic material and the way in which it disposed itself on the metal surface, on the interface. Now, the reason that paper was important is that by the time that paper came along, I was convinced that while these may not be great commercial inhibitors, there were distinct differences which were structurally related, and that had to depend on either of several possibilities or some combination, namely on the what I'll call the Lewis acid base characteristic. In most cases, these were electron donors. Mm-hmm. Or on its capacity to cover, which meant you had to know something about the architecture. And I began to be interested now in chemisorption rather than the physical absorption. So it was before others had talked about it, or it was in the early days, I began to think in terms of two-dimensional compounds on the interface. And this was an obvious this has an obvious involvement with catalysis and a whole lubrication, a whole bunch of interfacial phenomena. That's why I thought that paper was important. In fact, I gave a talk to the New York Academy of Sciences somewhere back in that time, in which I talked about two-dimensional compounds, and I got hooted at that. Guys didn't think of it was the kind of thing to talk about. It was too fanciful, not fancy. But that was in the early 50s. And now, of course, you see them. I mean, you do interferometry or you do scanning, tunneling microscopy or something like that, and they're there. But at that time, we had to infer. And so much of my research then went over to the business of what can you do with molecules that will permit you to make a prediction about what might happen. And that led to a very good series of papers with Aramaki on structures of polymethylene imines.
Oh, yes, yes. There's a number of those.
Yeah.
At the same time that that paper came out, there was another one which fits in with what you're just saying about charge transfer.
Yeah.
No bond adsorption.
Yeah, that was before its time, I've got to tell you. I think that was published in Journal of Chemical Physics.
I don't have the reference right in front of me.
But
that was 1954.
That was a little early. The response to that was zilch. It's good paper. Matz and I were on that paper, and my student McCrady's, I think, was on that paper. It was before its time, but nonetheless, it did presage what was going to happen in interface science.
I think I have a copy of it here, as a matter of fact.
Yeah, Journal of Chemical Physics. Al McCrady's had got his degree that year or the year before, maybe. I've got all of them lined up in a file someplace.
Well, around just a little bit after that, you had a patent which struck me as being somewhat out of the line of what you've been doing, and this was a process for de-inking printed white paper.
Actually, it was a little before that. Was it about 49, wasn't it?
This one was 56.
56, that length. Okay.
There was another one that came much later, too.
Yeah. That's right. It was not in line, but it was in line with the proposition that I would take on students who I thought were capable of doing something in the field of interfaces, if they came to me and said this is what they want to work on. And this guy had been in the paper industry, and he had an idea that he wanted to check, and I looked at it, and in fact I felt capable of helping him do it. That was the point. Now, what this was the proposition that the carbon particles adhered to the paper fiber, in large part electrostatically, and that if you could develop a solution which helped reduce or alter the charge on the carbon particles so that A was the same sign and B had a different value, you could cause them to spring apart by putting them in an electric field. And it worked. We just took a big iron pot and an iron electrode. I guess it was a cathode. The pot was the anode. And the solution, I don't remember, but it was a concoction. And I took newsprint, beat it up, put it in there, put the charge across this thing. It didn't. The solution wasn't a good conductor, so there's a big drop right at the anode, or the electrode. I can't remember if it was the anode or the cathode, but not the electrode. And what happened was the carbon just jumped out, left the white fiber right around the electrode, and all you had to do was draw it off, more stuff would come in. So we got this patent, which I gave to the student, a fellow named Crotal, because it was his idea to begin with. And he tried to sell it to the paper industry. This is the reason I thought it was in the 40s. Maybe by the time it was issued, it was that late.
Mm-hmm. It could have been applied for much earlier.
We tried to sell it to the paper industry at the time because after the war, paper from new pulp was $200 a ton or something like that. We thought we could do this for about $90 or $100 a ton. But the paper industry, like other old industries, you know, they circled the wagons. They didn't want to hear from us. This was different capital equipment, and recycling was not very popular at the time. You know, you burn the old paper and cut some new trees down, different trees down. So Crotal had the patent. I had assigned it to him. He spent a lot of time trying to convince the people in East Texas, for example, to use it. They never did. It's a good pet.
The two other papers in this time period that you identified, anodic phenomena at an iron electrode.
Yeah. The two interests I had in the field of corrosion, I'm not an engineer, so you know, I'm not really in corrosion as such. One of them was this business of the organic molecules and the way they oriented and the way they bound. And the other was an old interest in passivity. For some reason, while I was at graduate school, I got interested in it. It's a very peculiar phenomenon. I don't know how familiar you are with it. If you take a piece of iron and dip it into concentrated nitric acid, you get a lot of hydrogen coming off and then it stops. Or if you take a piece of iron and put it into less concentrated nitric acid or even sulfuric and pass current through it, the current stays high, you get to a certain potential, it drops way down and stays that way until you get to what's called the transpassive region, when iron begins to oxidize as FeO4, 2 minus, at 6 oxidation state. This passivity takes place on iron now with no apparent scale in between the metal and the solution, so whatever is formed is very thin. It has a very peculiar property, that is, it transmits electrons readily. Scale doesn't, you know, scale's an insulator. Iron oxide's either semiconductor and insulator. And you can destroy it by a variety of things. Chloride does it, for example. Or there's a old experiment known as the Lilly experiment. You take a piece of this, take an iron wire and put it in concentrated nitric acid. Hydrogen comes off momentarily in some brown gas, and it stops. And if you touch the top of it with a piece of copper, you see a pulse run down. It was known as a Lilly nerve model. And I've got an old 8mm movie of the experiments done at Bell Telephone Lab, I guess the early part of the century, I don't know how early it is, in which this Lilly nerve model was demonstrated. Well, anyway, and that's because the passivation has been destroyed by a pulse of current. I've always been interested in that, as I was in the oxygen electrode back in the 30s. I did a lot of work myself on the oxygen electrode, never solved the problem, but did a lot of work, and got interested in passivity. And I was convinced that there was no scale involved, and the Cambridge school, a guy named Evans, said there was a three-dimensional iron oxide that forms. It had only the peculiarity that it was dense. It had very little porosity. And that the reason for the passivation characteristic was just the pure separation of metal and solution. That didn't sound reasonable to me because the amount of current that flowed through that passive film was too high. You actually could use it, if you were careful, you could use it like an inert electrode. Mm-hmm. So I could do an electrometric titration of a redox couple if I wanted. Had to be very careful. You couldn't have chloride there and some other things. And that meant that current flowed through that thing like it was a metal, or it had to be very thin. It had the same kind of peculiarity that ceramic superconductors had, high temperature superconductors had. It passed current when it shouldn't have, or by our then standards. And I gave a paper at the first passivity conference, it was called, in Heidelberg in Germany, in which I suggested that the reason it was so conductive was that the iron-oxygen combination formed very rapidly, and the material was amorphous rather than crystalline, and that it spread rather than grew, rather than moving perpendicularly from the surface, it spread laterally across the surface. In a thin, it had to be well packed, it had to be non-porous, of sufficiently thin films so that electrons could move through it readily. And that meant of angstrom type thicknesses. That paper actually got some interest. Carl Wagner, I don't know if the name means anything to you. Wagner was one of the German scientists who was captured and brought over here at the end of the war, put out of Fort Bliss. A very general guy whose only interest was science. He had no family, no nothing. Was involved in the Heidelberg conference, and he got pretty interested in it. My Cambridge buddies jumped up and down on me at that meeting and said that was silly. Anybody knew it had to be iron oxide and had to be three-dimensional, and they could prove it because they would strip it off and show it to you. And I maintained that they were confusing cause and effect. What they stripped off was the stripping solution made iron oxide. We had serious arguments about that. Cause and effect is an interesting thing, by the way. It's what screws up most researchers, not keeping those straight, including mine, by the way. I don't mean to say other people, not just other people. At any rate, that paper was the last that I really did seriously in passivity. I figured if those jokers couldn't accept what was clear, the hell with them. So I haven't done much since then. There was a very good experimental paper I had with Wade. And this was one in which we did potential dynamics before it became a term. We would drive the potential across this passive region and then reverse it and come back. And you could make this whole thing reversible if you didn't go too far. If you went too far along that plateau, this was a current current on the abscissa and potential on the ordinate, and you change the potential and measure the current. You could drive across that plateau, and if you went only a certain fraction of distance, which we thought at one time was critical, but turns out not to be, you could go back and retrace the curve. If you went just a little further, the whole thing dissipated. You'd see the gas begin to form, and you'd go into the transpassive region. That Wade paper was a very good one. Wade, by the way, is a member of the faculty at Austin now.
Well, I did notice the Center for Electrochemical Research listed on the board at the department.
Mm-hmm.
When did that start? Was that much later?
Yeah, that's Alan Bard's.
Okay.
Okay. Stuff.
Yeah. He's on our list to talk to. Also.
Yeah. I was chairman. I'm sure I was chairman. We brought Bard in. He had been in Lingain's lab, and we brought him in. I brought him in because we had an opening in analytical. And I was pretty well convinced from talking to him that he was broader than just pure instrumental analytical. But we put him, and he's still in the analytical division, as a matter of fact. But he obviously is much broader than that.
You had made a comment earlier about the selection of new faculty and the fact that you were either were or were not successful in properly identifying them when they came in. Is there any, I mean, in retrospect, is there any reason for that? Is it, in a more general sense, let's look at it in a more general sense. Yeah. How do you identify a person for a slot that you have available in your department?
Well, the standard way, you know, you talk to him, you listen to his supervising professor, and you get recommendations, and you learn pretty quickly that unless somebody dislikes a person, they're always going to be much higher than you can expect out of them. So the question is, what kind of factor can you put on them? And that depends on who it is you're talking to. So you have to now evaluate the recommender rather than the recommendee. Furthermore, in the 50s, Austin was still a pretty isolated place. To get to it, you could fly in, but for example, if you flew down from Boston, you would go to New York. In New York, to Knoxville, Memphis, Nashville, Dallas, Fort Worth, Waco, Austin. It was not an easy trip, I'll tell you. Or you come by train and take an overnight, you know, two days and a night. And people on the east and west coast just weren't that easy to move. You could get the outdoorsman, but then you had a problem as to whether he came because he'd go hunting and fishing eat more readily, or because this guy you wanted. So what you sort of deliberately had to do was say, look, we know we're not going to get the best guys right at the beginning. What we want are people we can stepladder on. And we were perfectly willing to be lucky, too. It turns out we were lucky in at least two cases that I can think of offhand. One's Bard. Why Bard came down, you'll have to ask him. Because I can't tell. He was in New York born. He went to that New York high school. What's it called? The Bronx High School
of Science.
He'd been picked up from there and went to Harvard. And it seemed to me he had plenty of opportunities. But he did choose to come down there, and there was a great break for us because he's good. The other great break for us was Alan Kelly. Kelly's an inorganic chemist. He's currently a fellow of the Royal Society. He had taken a degree at Imperial College and was working with ICI when we found out about him, and I happened to be in England. It may have been for that passivity conference. I was coming back from Germany. And I talked to him, and he came. And it wasn't as evident at the beginning that was a great move. He was quite satisfactory, nothing wrong with him, good instructor. But he is he really has a first-class reputation as an inorganic chemist. They came about the same time. And that, I think, literally gave us the step on which we could begin to build with the people that Noyes had in mind, in physical chemistry specifically. But during that same period of time, we must have taken in, I'll say, 15 people, and kept those two, plus Nate Bald, who also came from Harvard, plus Steve Weber, and the others we let go.